Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. As some of you may know, over the past couple of years, I've done several webinars and video lectures on a variety of topics that also come up on this podcast. There is unfortunately a lack of qualified therapists who specialize in working with cult survivors and their concerned family members. And since I can only see a finite number of clients myself, I wanted to share insights from my 30 plus years of doing this work with as many people as possible. So, in pursuit of that goal, I've made all of my recent video lectures available on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. You can find a link to the page in the show notes of this episode. There you'll find my lecture from the most recent conference of the International Cultic Studies Association, my, quote, Living in Freedom, unquote, series for survivors and their family members, and my recent lecture entitled Why Did I Stay?, which examines the many reasons that people have difficulty leaving high control groups. We plan on adding more video lectures in the near future, so if you have topics you'd like to hear me cover, please feel free to reach out to us and make suggestions. Today on the show, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. John Hunter. He is a South African researcher and lecturer based in Johannesburg. His interest in large group awareness trainings and their impact on mood and psychosis is grounded in his personal experience of bipolar disorder and his participation in an LGAT, large group awareness training, in 2010. In 2017, he completed a PhD in psychology, proposing a neurobiological explanation for the relationship between LGAT conditions and results. In July 2023, he presented his work at the annual International Cultic Studies Association conference in Louisville, Kentucky, and in June 2024, acted as an expert witness in a United States federal court regarding the use of LGATs in the troubled teen industry. Dr. Hunter's upcoming first book, Manufacturing Mania, The Dopamine Hypothesis of Religious Experience, is due for release by the end of this year. More info on Dr. Hunter and his work is available at johnhunterphd.com. Here is John now. I am delighted to have John Hunter with me today. It is very exciting to be able to get your perspective and your expertise in all that you have studied and be able to share it with us today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Take a few moments and introduce yourself to the listeners, and then we'll start talking about your story and what brought you into being interested in this.
Sure. I'm John Hunter. I'm based in Johannesburg, South Africa. I completed my PhD on large group awareness trainings and bipolar disorder, kind of an interaction between the two, which I think is a relatively different thing to have done.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm curious, in order to do a PhD, a dissertation, that means really throwing yourself into doing lots of research, spending lots of time, which also then connotes great interest. So I'm wondering about your interest in this. Where did that get cultivated?
I actually didn't start with a focus on psychology. So my PhD is in psychology. I studied business initially at the University of Cape Town and worked in that space for about 10 years and wasn't particularly well suited to it, to be completely honest. But I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 2003 while I was living in London. And it was just such a strange experience. I mean, very frightening, but also very interesting to me. I just found it so amazing that the way that I viewed myself and the world and the future could be so distorted by essentially something going on in my brain. So for a long time after that, from about 2003 to 2010, I was really just studying bipolar disorder informally, trying to get the best understanding of it that I could. In 2010, I started working at a company in Durban, which is on the east coast of South Africa, or just outside of Durban. And I was asked to take part in two personal development seminars. So that's how they were marketed or sold to us at the time as part of the induction for this this position I'd taken up. And essentially they were large group awareness trainings, which I'd never heard of a large group awareness training. I had no reason to anticipate that there was going to be something incredibly stressful and distressing and disruptive, particularly for somebody like myself. But something that I did notice, having learnt about bipolar disorder, was that the key triggers for manic and hypomanic episodes were present in these seminars. And those key triggers were psychological stress, sleep disruption, and then goal attainment. So those were three things that I'd learned about and three things that I'd learned to be very cautious of as somebody with bipolar disorder, because they are known to elicit new episodes of the elevated states of bipolar disorder, which are known as hypomania and mania, and sometimes depression in people. So while I was taking part in the seminar, I was like, oh, this is really a bad place for me to be. And then after I completed the seminar, we'd been promised that we'd have the greatest day of our lives, which mania and hypomania kind of feel like the greatest day of your life. And we'd been promised some very specific things. And as I sort of reflected on things that we'd been promised, things that we'd been warned about, and the behavior of people around me that had gone through the seminar, I saw that it was the behavior and the thoughts and the feelings lined up with the elevated states of bipolar disorder. So what I was seeing in people were things like euphoria, excessive confidence, like no need for sleep, like elevated levels of productivity and energy, decisive behavior, or often impulsive behavior. So making big decisions without really thinking about it. So with that background of studying, I kind of thought, well, it's really strange that you've got this seminar that involves these established triggers for these elevated states, and it's leading to these established symptoms or indicators of these elevated states. And that really was interesting to me. And I tried to approach people that were PhDs in psychology and psychiatrists and various people at the university around me and tried to explain to them, this is what I think is going on, but you understand what a large group awareness training is. If you had tried to explain that this happens to somebody who'd never heard about it before, they're going to be incredibly skeptical because it seems completely unbelievable. You're kind of saying people are put through the worst conditions possible and then they feel better than they've ever felt in their lives. They have, you know, they feel amazing afterwards. So it was not a very believable thing. It was coming from somebody who had no training in psychology or psychiatry at the time. And it's also coming from somebody with bipolar disorder. So again, as somebody who's studied cults and that sort of thing, you understand that authority is such a useful thing to use when you are directing people in a particular direction. And you can elevate your authority status in a number of different ways. Telling somebody that you've got bipolar disorder is the opposite of that. It's really just undermining your credibility. So, you know, there were people who sort of listened to me for a little while, but I don't think they really took it seriously. So between 2010 and 2013, I carried on working. I left that company and I worked at another company. And then in 2013, I went back and studied psychology full time. So I did the undergrad, honors, master's, PhD, pretty much just straight through, and completed the PhD in end of 2017.
Incredible. I mean, you know, you never know what it is that's going to guide you in your life to change your path. But I'm very happy that you're now in this place where you're able to study this and you're able to see the dangers and you can understand it psychologically. Large group awareness trainings, before they were called that, and I'm really glad that there's a term for it now, were really quite prevalent. And it, you know, when I started in this field in the 80s, They're very popular, and there were so many, and there have been so many since. And so many people who have contacted me who have also said that they needed to do this as part of their work if they were going to keep their jobs, which is really, you know, quite wrong, especially because people are then getting into certain modes that could be really dangerous to them. And it feels like a trap too, because when you are riled up, when you're sort of worked up into a froth, I know a number of people who have been kicked out of their cultic groups because they suddenly had a psychotic break or they suddenly were not able to function. But it was created by the perfect storm within the group. So here you are doing exactly as it's set up to have you do, where you're impacted by everything they're doing to you, and it's just too much for your system. And then you're told there's something defective about you.
And I think that this happens with so many people, is that they have that negative reaction and they wonder what's wrong with them. They don't realize that it's far more common than is reported by a lot of these organizations. And so, yeah, they're kind of on their own. They leave maybe halfway through, or it happens afterwards. And then if they try to get in touch with somebody, there's never any acknowledgement of the problem. So even when the organizations, and you speak of the organizations that were operating in the 70s and 80s, numerous lawsuits against them, almost all of them were settled out of court with the proviso that no responsibility was accepted by the organization. So there were big payouts, but it's like, well, we didn't do anything wrong. You know, I've been in touch with some people who've left a very big, large group of awareness training organization recently. And you hear them starting to talk about the fact that there were far more people that were having these negative reactions than what the public is made aware of. And I think when they were parts of this organization, they also couldn't understand that there was a relationship between what was taking place in the seminars and these reactions. And that's always been the defense. It's always been, well, you know, people can have a psychotic break anywhere. So somebody can be in the supermarket and have a breakdown. What is what we're doing have to do with these things that could happen at any time? And that's really what my research, I think the major value that it adds is it shows exactly why what's taking place in these seminars can lead to exactly those sorts of negative reactions.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You know, when sometimes people will ask me what kind of motivated me to want to do this work. And one of the answers to that question, there are a number of things, but one of the answers was when I was studying to become a therapist when I was at USC. When they asked in this class of people studying in this program what you would provide for your client, for your patient, as an adjunct to therapy, what you would offer them as some ideas, and a lot of people said meditation, or they said exercise or whatever else, there were a number of people who said I would refer them to fill in the blank large group awareness training. It was really helpful to me, and this is something, or I've heard of it, and I think it would be really great. And having already learned about cultic systems growing up in the family that I did because of a family member having gotten involved in one, I thought, oh no. And these are people who are therapists who really don't know. They don't know that they're going to be throwing their client into a potentially dangerous situation. And there is this whole idea of authority too, where if your therapist tells you this is going to be helpful to you, then you might not question it. And so all the more reason I thought I need to be on the other side of this to be able to prevent this as much as possible. But it happens quite often.
Yeah, I mean, I know that it's been the case in South Africa. There were certainly some, you know, clinical psychologists who were recommending individuals to go to specific seminars. And I mean, I think it comes with that authority thing. I mean, you're a licensed therapist. You realize that you're not perfect, that you don't know everything. But I think often from the perspective of the client or the patient, they put the therapists on a pedestal and think these people must know absolutely everything. Therefore, I'm going to outsource my thinking to them. So as you say, the trust is there. They kind of rely on that model the whole way through, though. So it may be an employer, and that employer might be somebody that you look up to or trust. But very frequently, it's a family member or a friend who's in the state of, you know, what they call transformation, and is feeling incredibly good and is feeling like their life is transformed. And they are recruiting their brother or their sister or their girlfriend or wife or child or whatever it is. And so every person that goes into an LGAT, or almost every person, is going in there with the sense of social proof, the sense of somebody has recommended this to me, somebody that I trust, somebody that whose judgment I think is probably quite good. And I think if you didn't have that, most people would, well, I don't know if most people, but a lot more people would get up and walk out early on when it starts getting a little bit strained.
Right. You know, sometimes people also will ask me, who gets involved in something like this? And I will often answer that sometimes it's a who question, but often it's a when question. Like if they've started at a company and then the company says, you need to do this, or they're going through a particularly hard time, or they just dealt with getting a diagnosis, and that people are really taken advantage of during periods of transition, difficult times. And I remember getting some pushback about that thought, that a group like this, somehow it's sort of seen as higher level, it would know not to take advantage of people. So luckily, I have this piece of paper given to me by someone who was an instructor in the organization called Insight Seminars.
Yeah.
So, right. And so it's from the same model, basically.
Yes.
Right. And so many
others.
Is
that John Rogel?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. He's an interesting person. But in any event, this piece of paper she handed me, it says to basically, here are the places where you're supposed to be recruiting people in. It says sort of like offering them this opportunity or whatever language it is. But it has hospitals, outside hospitals, or in waiting areas in hospitals, outside counseling centers, the prison system, funerals, it actually said. And so I just show people the fact that this is what they do in a completely shameless way, which is really quite unbelievable. But taking advantage of these transitional, unsure times in people's lives, I think is unconscionable, but it happens so often.
For sure. And I mean, I certainly know that that maybe some of the pushback that comes is because there certainly are people that aren't in those stages that end up in LGATs. And as you said, it might just be you're at work and somebody, some boss of yours says, you've got to do it. I think the other side of that, though, is that you brought into the first seminar, and it seems particularly in that case, they're targeting people in vulnerable situations. But then when you finish the seminar and you're in an elevated state, you are particularly vulnerable to buy things. I mean, that is what a hypermanic or manic state involves, making big decisions, spending money without thinking about the consequences. So certainly when they're getting people to sign up for the next course, then they're in a particularly vulnerable state. So I would say at the beginning, there's that possibility, but then certainly for the follow-on seminars, that's going to be the case as well. People are tired, they're exhausted, and they're really elevated and likely to make big decisions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know, they have you sign so many forms, a lot of non-disclosure agreements, which, you know, you want bells and whistles to go off, you know, when someone is having you do that. But people who have tried to sue and have not won, even if they've wound up really damaged by what has happened there, and these groups have a way of protecting themselves. I want to be able to get into the psychology that you've uncovered, and the psychology and also the social psychology, because there's so much of that is in place there. The not only the social contagion, but the not wanting to be the only one who doesn't seem to be getting it. You know, that piece of it. So let's get into the science. So, you know, what have you begun to uncover here that, I mean, I think is really fascinating and really important to show that it's not just something that you do for a weekend and a workshop. It really has a scientific method, whether it was, I don't think it was created that way purposely. I don't think it was created with that kind of knowledge. It just has, because that would be kind of giving them too much credit, I think, right?
Agreed.
It just happens, yes. Right? It just happens to have this impact. And now that they know it, they don't care. That's the problematic part. Yeah. So let's talk about it. So what can you teach us about the science?
All right. So what I would do is I'd break it down into saying the psychology of influence and then maybe the neurobiology of influence. I'd break it into those two different components. So in terms of the psychology, I would look at something called the elaboration likelihood model. So this was a model of persuasion put forward, I think, in the late 1970s, early 1980s by Petty and Cacioppo. And the chapter in the book in which it was published has been cited more than 16,000 times. So this is a really well-accepted model of persuasion within psychology. And very basically what it says is that people can either be persuaded through the central route or through the peripheral route. And anyone that's read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow will be able to see the parallels between the central route and system two thinking and the peripheral route and system one thinking. But let me just try to clarify those. The central route is if you're persuading somebody and you say to them, okay, I want to convince you of something. I'm going to give you all of the information that is relevant to making a decision about this thing. I'm going to give it to you in the simplest possible format. I'm going to give you as much time as possible. And I'm going to convince you that you actually have the intelligence and the ability to think through this and work it out for yourself, and that it's important for you to think through it yourself and work it out. That's central route persuasion. It's the way that's least unethical. So if a person makes a decision based on that sort of persuasion, it's going to be something that they own entirely. The peripheral route is doing everything that you can. And I don't want to make it seem that it's completely binary. You can kind of be on a spectrum between central route and peripheral route. But the peripheral route is kind of persuading people with the opposite of that. So you minimize the chances that they're going to be motivated to think through the evidence for themselves, or that they're going to be able to think through the evidence for themselves. So they're going to feel like either completely overwhelmed by the amount of information that you're providing, or they're going to be incredibly tired, or some combination of the two. Or you might say to them, there's no point in you trying to understand this. Understanding is actually a bad way of getting to this thing. It's going to get in the way of you truly getting this thing. And the right way for you to actually understand is by something like natural knowing or trusting the experience or something like that. And also, when you give the person information, you give them way too much information in a short period of time. You make it difficult for them to understand. You get them really tired. You give them confusing terms that they don't really know what you're talking about, all that sort of thing. All right. So if you're persuading somebody through the peripheral route like that, you get them to a state in which they are not motivated and they are not able to think through the information for themselves. And when you're in that situation, you're far more likely to rely on what are called peripheral cues. And peripheral cues are heuristics. They are shortcuts. They are ways of making a decision about something without thinking through that thing on your own. So, for example, if you convince a person that you're an authority about something, then and the person feels like there's no way I'm ever going to be able to understand this thing for myself, and the authority figure says, this is what the answer is, then you might just go, okay, well, I'm going to trust this person and I'm going to take on that information. If you convince the person that the group around them knows what's going on, so if a person's looking around them and the group seems to know what's going on, even if they don't, if they seem to be kind of going along with what's being said, then you might say, okay, well, they seem to be going along with this. I'm going to trust them because I'm too tired. I don't have the ability. I don't have the motivation to think through this for myself. So we know about a number of different peripheral cues that will operate when people aren't thinking for themselves. A very important one in the context of large group awareness trainings is something called the affect heuristic. And affect, obviously, is emotion. So if we are feeling really good or positive when we hear a certain piece of information, we might associate that positive feeling with the information. And so if it feels good to us, we might believe it or think that it's more valid or worthwhile. All right, so If we think about what goes on in a large group awareness training, you're keeping people there from 9 in the morning till, 10 at night earliest, often 11, 12 at night. There's homework on top of that every night. So they'll give you homework to go home and have a look at. The interactions are very stressful, and stress depletes your resources. Additionally, you're often asked to be kind of in a state of vigilance. And again, that is going to drain your prefrontal cortex, your ability to kind of focus and concentrate. Access to food and water is often quite limited as well. Access to the bathrooms. I mean, I know they say, we never stop somebody from going out, but they make a big deal about staying in the room for as much time as possible. You don't know when the next break is going to be, and that causes uncertainty, and that can be cognitively draining as well. Then a huge amount of information is provided, huge amounts of information, and often it's using jargon, words that you haven't heard before, or they're using words that you know, but they're using them in a different way. So every time that you hear them, you've got to think about the fact that it means something else. That's draining. And this goes on for 3 days. So people are getting really tired, overload of information. Then you've often got the trainer or the seminar leader saying things quite explicitly like, stop analyzing, come from your heart, not your head. Understanding is the booby prize. Like, people that are thinking about things and pushing back to the trainers are often chastised for thinking too much, or for trying to be clever, or for not being coachable. That's a thought terminating cliche that they'll use. So you've got this environment which is perfectly designed for peripheral route persuasion. Additionally, participants, at least until very recently, and I don't know what the story is right now, they're not allowed to take notes. That's one of the rules that you've got to agree to. So you can't write anything down. You can't speak to anyone next to you. You can't check your ideas with anyone. So you're in a situation where you're sitting there like, how do I make sense of what's going on? It's far more likely that you're going to rely on peripheral cues, and you've got this authority figure who's really built himself or herself up as knowing everything. Maybe I'll trust this person. You've got the group, which seems to be agreeing with what's going on. And often they're plants in the seminar, or they're people that are taking the seminar again that people don't know about. They're responding in a very particular way, and they're getting the right responses from this quite aggressive leader. And so you start thinking, that's the right thing to do. And then at the end of the seminar, they generate this really powerful positive affective state, which participants who are tired and depleted and are relying on peripheral cues are far more likely to use as a substitute for evidence in that environment. So that's what I would say is the psychological process that's going on.
Incredible. What's interesting too, I'm checking in with myself physiologically, even just as you are listing all of these things, and it is overwhelming. And I think about feeling trapped. I think about feeling exhausted, confused, being in a room with lots of other people who are probably trying to seem like they're getting it, and you're probably not, and they're probably not. But by looking at them, you think you might be the only one who's not, and what that feels like. And having plants in the room, I mean, I remember checking out an organization. I checked out the Los Angeles office and the New York office when I was there, of a group called the Kabbalah Learning Center. And for their introductory class, they always had, I mean, I was checking it out because people were contacting me saying they were having experiences that were not great. They always have plants in the room come over to work on you when it seems like you're, having a hard time. Like, you just can't speak to anyone else who might be struggling, and you can't check out the fact that maybe things don't make sense. And it feels also like what's going to get lost in all of this is, why? Why are you being told that you shouldn't be thinking and that you shouldn't be doing this and shouldn't be doing that? And why is this word translated in another way? And how is that going to help me in my life? But you're just already on the hamster wheel. And I think you just no longer have the distance, the vantage point to ask why.
They prime people, and it's very important. So the person that recruits you in the first place will say something to you like, I can't give you any details about what goes on, but you have to trust the process. And then when you arrive, they'll also say things like, listen, somebody's recommended this to you, you trust them, right? And they've said to you that it's going to be uncomfortable and you're not going to understand what's happening and whatever, but you need to trust the process. You're like, okay, so they've already set up the system. So when you are sitting there and you're going, this seems really not okay, or this is a bit weird, there's that situation. You know, in a lot of organizations, they'll say, this is like a roller coaster. You know, there's going to be ups and downs. It's going to be feeling quite frightening at times, but it's really dangerous to get off before the end. In our course, they said, this is like a course of antibiotics. You know, you have to finish the course for it to work properly. So there's all of that. And then even when people were kind of pushing back against the trainer, he would say, well, this is what you're like in your life. You can't follow through on anything. You committed at the beginning to complete the seminar, and this is how you operate in life. You just give up on everything. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. I would say that there are a couple of other things, and these would fall under what Lifton would call mystical manipulation. So other things that are going on that participants are not aware of that are influencing them without their awareness. So for example, you know, if you read Kahneman and some of the other social psychologists, they speak about reciprocal connections. So the idea that, you know, our minds, we often think of them in working in one direction, but they actually work in two directions a lot of the time. So we make connections between various things. So I'll give you an example. There's something called the facial feedback hypothesis. And the idea is that if we're happy, we'll smile, but also if we force ourselves to smile, it can actually make us feel happier because our brain associates the smiling with the happiness. So usually it's feeling happy, then smile, but if we smile, and they've done studies on that sort of thing. There were another couple of studies where they, for example, they said to two groups of people, they said, we'd like to test out this audio equipment. So they gave them earphones and they played something in the background. They didn't kind of say, pay attention to it. They just said, we'd like you to try to elicit distortions, you know, by moving your head around. One group they told to nod their heads up and down. One group they said, shake your head from side to side. And then afterwards, they asked the groups a bunch of questions. Some of them related to the contents of what was being played in the background. And the people that were nodding their heads were far more likely to agree with the content than the people that were shaking their heads from side to side, because nodding is associated with agreements. So how does this relate to LGATs? LGATs very often have a rule where they say there are going to be times where you have to applaud. And they're very specific times when that takes place. And it almost always takes place when a participant's been having an engagement with the leader. So there's often these one-on-one interactions and the participant might be pushing back or disagreeing or whatever. And then as soon as the trainer or the seminar leader or whatever gets the upper hand, then this person is considered to have a breakthrough. So they will say, let's applaud and thank this person for being vulnerable. But what's really happening is that everyone is furiously applauding as if they are agreeing with whatever perspective has been put forward by the trainer. So that's something that people don't know about. You mentioned the fact that, you know, people don't have access to all of the information. They can't speak to people. We know from, you know, Robert Cialdini and various other people that if you're only hearing part of the story, you are going to not even necessarily realize that there's another side to it. So by controlling the information like that, you're only hearing one side. He also speaks about repetition as being something. If you go into large group awareness training, the seminar leaders tend to say things over and over and over again. And people are not very good at distinguishing between things that we hear frequently and things that are true. So particularly when we are, you know, what in what Kahneman would call system one thinking or sort of peripheral routes sort of thinking. If we are tired and we're not thinking very carefully about something, if we hear something over and over again, it's going to seem like it's true to us. So my comments to people that say that there's no manipulation going on in large group awareness trainings is always, what do you understand about it? We can run through Lifton's 8 conditions. Every single one of them is in place in most large group awareness trainings. All of these elements that have been identified by Cialdini are in place in these seminars. So that would be the psychological manipulation. The other side of it is, how are they actually generating these elevated affective states that they use as a peripheral lever? So that is, you know, probably the primary part of my research and my PhD was on that. So I noticed that the triggers for mania and hypomania, these elevated states, were present in these seminars. So stress, sleep disruption, and goal attainment. And I saw that the symptoms or indicators of mania or hypomania were there. So euphoria, confidence, energy, productivity, decisiveness, sometimes creativity, those kinds of things. And so I thought to myself, okay, there's something going on here that relates to bipolar disorder. So what do I know about bipolar disorder? The first thing that I looked at was something called the manic defense hypothesis. And this is this really old psychoanalytic theory from 1911 by a guy named Carl Abraham, who was a student of Freud's. And his very basic idea was that mania seems to be an overcompensation of a defense against feelings of inadequacy and negative feelings, basically. So if a person is made to feel really bad about themselves, then using the psychoanalytic explanation, this unconscious force emerges that pushes against the negative feelings. So you've got negative feelings making you feel bad about yourself. And so this unconscious force pushes back and allows you to stay effectively in homeostasis. And Abraham's theory was that in people with bipolar disorder, this unconscious force becomes so powerful that instead of just keeping you in balance, it pushes you and elevates you. And that is what mania and hypomania. And while it's a, you know, Freudian psychoanalytic explanation, and we might scoff at some of that type of thinking, the idea of homeostasis is very well accepted within biology and psychology and that today. So the idea that our body and our brains want us to stay in balance, we don't like to be feeling uncomfortable. So if we're cold, our body does something to help regulate our body temperature, or hot. Or if we are threatened by something, you know, our brain kicks in the HPA axis, we start producing adrenaline and cortisol, and it allows us to cope with various situations. So from that, I kind of got the idea of, well, maybe there's a homeostatic response to feelings that are psychological feelings that are negative. So feelings of guilt and shame and inadequacy and fear, which are really elevated during large group awareness trainings. I was like, well, maybe our body is trying to protect us from that in some way. And this protection kind of goes out of control through some sort of mechanism. So that was the one part. So when I was looking at more recent theories for bipolar disorder, one is called the dopamine hypothesis of bipolar disorder. And the very basic idea is that an elevation of dopamine, particularly subcortical dopamine, so in the mesolimbic pathway, plays a significant role in hypomania and mania, and a depletion of dopamine leads to depressive symptoms. And there's a lot of good reasons for thinking that that might be the case. And I can run through a couple of those, maybe just to give it a bit of context.
Yeah, so, great.
And maybe for your listeners as well who don't know what dopamine is. So our brains are made up of about 100 billion neurons, which are these cells, these specialized cells. And the way that these neurons communicate with each other is that they send electrochemical signals. So they build up a little electrical impulse, and that allows them to release chemicals. And the chemical kind of floats from one neuron to another neuron, and it kind of binds and it says, you need to start doing something and we need to stop doing something. And there are a bunch of these chemicals, and they're known as neurotransmitters. So you might have heard of dopamine and serotonin, and in America, it would be called norepinephrine and GABA and these sorts of things. And you might think of them as words or phrases that communicate different things depending on where they are operating in the brain. So dopamine is a particular chemical that operates in certain parts of the brain. So the dopamine hypothesis of bipolar disorder is essentially that when you've got a really high level of dopamine binding in this one part of your brain, you start experiencing hypomanic or manic symptoms. And if you've got very low levels, then you start experiencing depressive symptoms. And the reason that they think that dopamine plays a role is For example, if you give a person drugs that elevate dopamine, you often start seeing symptoms that look very similar to hypomania and mania. So if you give somebody levodopa, so people with Parkinson's disease have got a breakdown of dopamine-producing neurons in a particular part of the brain. So often they're given levodopa, which elevates dopamine. Sometimes they'll start displaying symptoms that look similar to hypomania. There have been exercises where they've stimulated the nucleus accumbens, which is a part of the brain that's targeted by dopamine, in people with ADHD and I think in people with Parkinson's disease. And they've also started to display hypomanic and manic-like symptoms. Then in people with Parkinson's disease, we know that it's because of the breakdown of neurons in the substantia nigra. And I'm sure you know, with people with Parkinson's disease, you often see problems with motor things, so problems with movements and that kind of thing. There's some people that have got Parkinson's disease and bipolar disorder. So in some of these people, there have been case studies where while they've been having manic episodes, their motor function has improved. So while they're having a manic episode, which we think may be related to an elevation in dopamine, then you start seeing the movements improving. So there are a number of reasons for thinking that dopamine might play a role. So I looked at this hypothesis and I said, okay, well, if dopamine is maybe leading to these sorts of symptoms that we see in bipolar disorder and that we're seeing in people coming out of large group awareness trainings, is there some sort of relationship between these known triggers, stress, sleep disruption, and goal attainment, and dopamine? And there was quite a large body of literature on this already. So what I found was that since the sort of 1970s, 1980s, they'd been finding that acute stress, so high levels of stress, can often lead to an elevation of dopamine. So I was like, okay, well, LGATs involve a lot of stress, so that's going to cause an elevation of dopamine. Additionally, what they found is that putting a person or an animal through periods of stress also makes the dopamine system more sensitive to rewards. And then we also know that rewarding events elevate dopamine. So if you eat a piece of cake or you have sex or something, dopamine is elevated. And that's the first thing that we kind of knew about dopamine, is that it responded to rewarding events. But basically what you've got now is you've got stress elevates dopamine. Stress also makes the dopamine system more sensitive to rewards that follow. And then rewarding events elevate dopamine. So what is going on in a large group awareness training? You've got stress for like 3-4 days, punctuated with periods of relaxation, which is maybe causing an elevation in dopamine to make people feel like they can cope with the situation. But also the dopamine system is now very sensitive. So if something rewarding happens, it's going to respond in a very powerful way. At the end of the seminar, the stress and the abuse is, in my view, is removed and it's replaced with a sense of love and affirmation, and you've graduated and you're wonderful and everyone's hugging and dancing and all this sort of thing. So you've got this incredibly, this huge social reward. So in my view, large group awareness trainings, theoretically speaking at least, are perfectly designed to cause a massive elevation in dopamine.
Wow. Yeah. So just to jump in for a moment here, I think it's interesting too, because you're describing so many things that dovetail into other things that I hear about or that I've studied. I haven't heard it spoken about in this way, and I love being able to see it. I sort of see a whole chart as you're talking about it. This idea, to going back to Cialdini, the ideas that he has in his book and that he talks about, one of which being scarcity. I think that there is a rush, a dopamine rush, when you feel like you have found the only or the true or the route towards. And when it is presented that way, only here will you be able to, you know, fill in the blank. And especially if it's through your work, you weren't looking for anything. And suddenly they present you with an idea of something you can get here that you seem to need to want now. And now it's the place that's going to give it to you. Also, you don't take time to think, did I even need that or want that before? And maybe not. But just the idea that they would say that it's like antibiotics. I mean, just think about the hubris involved in that, right? Like, really? It's the same thing? I don't think so. But this idea that you can't stop now, but also we have this thing that only exists here that can help you in some way as though you're ill, like you need these antibiotics. So interesting to play on your head in this way. But I also think this idea, as you were talking about it, that when people are caught up in needing to go through this whole process that is so uncomfortable and then be kind of enveloped and have this wonderful experience afterwards, it sounds like people are put through their paces of intermittent gratification, which is mind-bending, which I think people don't realize how controlling it is and how addictive it can be. And a lot of people will, when they're asked, unfortunately, because I think it's an unfair question, why did you stay in something like this or in a relationship, the relationship that you were in? I think that's putting the onus on the victim, but still, it's a commonly asked question. Part of the answer is because I was waiting. I was waiting to get that relief or that release that let me know that I was on the right path or that what I was doing was worth it. So it does feel like it dovetails into all of these other mechanisms that are used to control people.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I'm working with a colleague at the moment. You know, I explained my work to her and she said, this sounds a lot like abusive interpersonal relationships. And I said, yeah, I mean, I'm sure it is. It's just on a group level as opposed to one-on-one. So we've submitted a proposal for an article called Addicted to Love, which is exactly on this. And I think it's important to speak about the fact that for your listeners, dopamine and the dopamine pathway, that same pathway that I'm speaking about, is the central pathway in addiction. That is the pathway that you look at. So if it is leading to these elevations in dopamine, it's not just metaphorical that people are getting addicted to these relationships or addicted to these seminars. From a biological perspective, the biology, the overlap is very clear as well. And dopamine used to be thought of as the pleasure chemical, and the pathway used to be thought of as the pleasure pathway. But what we've found more recently is that it's not, and this again goes to what you were saying about that anticipation, it's not so much about pleasure, it's about the anticipation of pleasure. So Wolfram Schultz, I think he's at Oxford University, he did these studies on monkeys, and basically he would show a little light, and then the monkeys would be given some food, and then he would see what was going on in their brains. And basically, dopamine would elevate immediately after getting the food, the reward. And he was like, okay, great. And then he would do this a couple more times. He'd shine the light, and then they'd have to do something to get the food. And what he found was that after a short amount of time, dopamine wasn't elevating when they got the reward. Dopamine was elevating when the light shone, because that indicates to the monkey, I need to do something to get that reward. So there's this anticipation of pleasure, and dopamine produces the energy and the motivation to work towards something. It produces hope. It produces optimism. And that's why when people feel this elevated state, it feels so good. And it doesn't feel like I'm feeling good right now, like I'm eating a piece of chocolate cake and I feel good now. It feels like life is going to be brilliant. And that's why when people go through these seminars and they're recruiting family and friends, they feel like my life is forever better. And I can identify with this. I've been hypermanic a number of times, even while I've been on medication and that sort of thing. And every time that it happens, you just feel like, oh, I'm amazing. The world is great. Everything's going to be brilliant. And then when I'm depressed, it's the opposite. And all of the intellect in the world, you know, knowing about what depression is, I still feel worthless. I still feel like I've added no value, that people don't want to be around me, all of those sorts of things. And our biology drives our thinking far more than a lot of us realize.
Oh, it's really fascinating. And this addictive to love idea, this whole sort of limerence, right? And the idea, how much you're dealing with the forces of chemicals of what's being released in your body, but it's being translated, I think, in your mind as being real. It can be quite devastating too when you realize that it was something that was kind of created, manufactured by the system around you, and that it might not be something that you can sustain. That's a very hard thing.
Yeah. I mean, when I try to explain bipolar disorder to my students, so I've lectured students on psychopathology, and bipolar disorder is one of the disorders we'll focus on. You know, most of them, I won't even ask them if any of them have got bipolar disorder. That'd be a bit invasive. But what I will say is, has anyone ever been in love before? You know, and you know, most of them, they'll put their hands up. And that to me is the best comparison that can be made, because when you're in love, you see the world in this really positive light. You see this person that you're in love with through a really distorted lens. I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said, love is a gross exaggeration of the difference between one person and everyone else. And most people can identify with that. And they could, and I also often say to them, have you ever been in love with somebody and then you're not in love with them anymore, and you look back at them through, you know, normal lens? And they kind of go, yeah, I don't know what I was thinking. And very similar to the elevated states of bipolar disorder, where everything just seems more positive. Everything seems like it will work out. Your view is very distorted. And I think a very similar thing can be seen in people leaving large group awareness trainings. And that's why they make impulsive decisions. That's why they quit their jobs, because they think that something else great is going to happen. That's why they leave their spouses sometimes. It seems like a good idea at the time. And then afterwards, when they come back down, it's very much the same as coming down from a manic episode. And you're like, what was I thinking? What was I doing?
Right. I mean, I feel like that's one of the reasons that people sign up to then be on staff and to be an instructor and to stay in that system, because that seems like just, you know, that's going to continue the high. And it feels like that's the right decision at the time. So, yeah. So let's continue. This is really, really interesting. So tell me more about some of the things that you've studied.
The two primary things really would be those things. So it's a case of, how are these seminars getting people to move away from central route type thinking to peripheral route type thinking? What are the things that they are doing that affect thinking when you are in that peripheral route kind of phase? So some of them are quite well established: the repetition, the control of information, the authority figures, the social proof, that kind of thing. And then the shift in affect, that massive positive experience at the end. I think that those are some of the big things. And then how are they actually generating these positive states? And I think it's through the elevation of dopamine, although I think other things are contributing as well. So for example, high levels of stress lead to elevated levels of oxytocin and elevated endorphins. And both of those lead to social bonding, which probably plays a role in that bonding of people after these events, and in, you know, abusive interpersonal relationships as well. And endorphins also feel really good. So they're internal painkillers. They're bonding to the same receptors as things like heroin. So it feels really good. And that probably contributes to the experience in some way. The step that is really important is not just how they're generating the elevated states, but how does what takes place in an LGAT lead to the claimed negative effects? And so the claimed negative effects for the last 50 years have been pretty similar. Lots of claims of psychosis, claims of manic-like behavior, instability and mood, depression, claims of suicide, those sorts of things. So how do we make sense of that? Well, there's the dopamine hypothesis of bipolar disorder, but there's also the dopamine hypothesis of psychosis, or the dopamine hypothesis of schizophrenia. And there have been articles, thousands of articles written about the relationship between dopamine and psychosis. If you give somebody amphetamines, which elevates dopamine, if you give anybody enough of them, they will start becoming psychotic. So this will happen to to anyone. So the claims of psychosis, you can kind of understand if there's a big elevation in dopamine. If people are exposed to stress for too long, so chronic stress, there's also a lot of research that shows that this leads to depletion of dopamine. And depletion of dopamine is associated with certain depressive symptoms. So instead of feeling incredibly optimistic from an elevation in dopamine, you're going to feel incredibly pessimistic. And instead of feeling like full of hope, you're going to feel like there's no purpose in anything. So depressive symptoms have been associated with chronic stress and with the depletion of dopamine in the literature. So what you see is that while, you know, in the 70s and 80s, while there were these attempts to sue these organizations, a lot of them were relatively successful, but this was without them even knowing that what was taking place in the seminars could be directly linked to the sorts of injuries that were being claimed by participants.
Wow. It's interesting. I mean, to talk about the whole social psychological piece, I think would be really interesting here because, you know, there's so much dovetails into that. And I think, you know, as you're talking, you talk about, I mean, I guess it would be good for us to get into the group part of the large group awareness training. And while these techniques, I think, would be successful in their own right, one-on-one, as they are in relationships, as they are in smaller groups, having there be this large group, I think, is very powerful in other ways, in ways that I think also the leadership doesn't even quite have to work as hard because there's so much that you're being informed about or being made to believe. You can come up with certain hypotheses based on what you're seeing around you. You don't also want to be the only one. And there is this manufactured closeness. This is now your new community, and you've been through something together, like being in the trenches. You know, we've been through something difficult, which does breed a certain amount of closeness. You get into, you know, your deepest, darkest everything, which also manufactures closeness. But these relationships are so highly conditional, which is also so devastating for people. So let's talk about the social piece, what you've found out.
Yeah, so I mean, to be honest, this hasn't been a major area of my focus, but just speaking about it now, I would say everything is exaggerated or turned up because you're in a group of people. So one of the major ways that stress is generated in LGATs is through what they call sharing. In my view, it's basically just confession. So if you think about confessing your innermost secrets to a priest, it's you and the priest, and you still may feel a huge sense of, you know, shame about speaking about this to one person. This gets magnified if you're sharing something terrible that you've done or been through or that you're struggling with, and you're doing it in front of dozens or hundreds of people. So in large group awareness trainings, there's a combination of what they call sharing, which I would describe as confession, and accepting responsibility. Responsibility is the primary idea that's pushed in most of these seminars. So the idea that you're responsible for everything that goes on in your life. And people will share about really sensitive topics. So, you know, think of the most sensitive topics that you can think of. People will speak about something that's happened to them, and the trainer will effectively say, you need to take responsibility for that. Or the way that you're thinking about that is the source of your pain. So if you thought about this in a more positive way, then it wouldn't be as much of a problem. And often the confrontational sort of interactions between the seminar leader and participants is because the participant is kind of going, well, how can it be my responsibility that I was raped when I was 14 years old or something like that? And the ideology of the group in question will be imposed on that person until they effectively accept responsibility for, you know, what's going on. And those running the seminars will say things like, no, we didn't say that they are to blame or whatever, but that idea seems to come through quite a lot in terms of the way that people interpret it. And so that can be very psychologically stressful, obviously for the person who's standing up with a microphone in front of people speaking about it, But equally for people who are sitting there and kind of going, like, this is not okay. I'm not comfortable with this. And then you feel like maybe I should have said something or done something, and then you didn't do something. And then that's how I certainly felt. So I didn't share anything particularly stressful about myself, but there were people that were sharing, and the way that the leader of the seminar was interacting with them, I didn't think was okay. And I tried to challenge the person, and I was kind of shouted down. And eventually I just sort of sat down. And I thought, well, you know, I want to keep my job. What do I do? But then afterwards you feel really terrible about the fact that you haven't done anything. So there's a lot of stuff going on that, as I say, is heightened because there are lots of people. And then at the end, when there's graduation and you're wonderful and you've whatever, then that's also heightened because now you've got this group of people that, as you say, you've been through something with, that you've bonded with. That's, yeah, and it's not going to be the same level of social reward as if there were three people doing it. If there are 50 people doing it, it's going to feel all that much better.
Right. I think it's wonderful that you tried to challenge a person there who was instructing. And I don't know if you remember the topic that you were challenging them on, but I'm wondering also about the response you got and what it was about the response that shut you down. Was it what they said or the look on their face or the, you know, the force of their voice? I mean, how are people responded to in these situations?
So, I mean, I definitely think that it differs from seminar to seminar. So I did it at an organization in South Africa that's relatively small, that there's not much monitoring of what's going on there. And so I think that this person could get away with being a lot more explicitly brutal than some of the bigger organizations. I think that they've evolved since the early 70s. So I think there was a lot of shouting and that sort of thing. So John Hanley writes about, you know, when he was running LifeSpring seminars, he said, yeah, I would shout at people sometimes and that sort of thing. I think that that happens less and less in the bigger organizations. I think that the leaders are far more adept at making you feel stupid or silly than having to, you know, scream somebody down, which was basically the case in my seminar. I just got screamed at by this person, and it's a difficult situation. I had a home to pay off in Johannesburg. I just started a new job, and it seemed perfect. And so you kind of say to yourself, well, you know, let me just get through this and I'll think about making any big decisions afterwards. But yeah, when people are being kind of, in my view, abused around you and you're not doing anything, then it's kind of cold comfort to say, well, let me think about this afterwards. And it makes you feel like, why did I not do more at the time?
Right, right. Of course. Right. But it seems like you were weighing and measuring, you know, sort of the pros and cons of saying something, doing something, and that you needed to support, you know, you needed to continue getting the paycheck, which makes sense. I wonder, though, about the screaming and whether it is that it comes with that amount of volume in every situation, or if it's just the words or the countenance, something that just makes you feel almost shame for even having brought something up. I often think of this term that sort of popped into my head one time when I thought about trickle-down narcissism. It sort of happens in these groups where the leader, if that is what the leader is dealing with, which happens more often than not in a lot of cultic groups, they develop a system and their instructors follow suit that kind of live out and recreate how they would interact with people or how they would like to, and protecting basically their ego, like, through these other instructors. And so you learn, just as with a narcissist, that you can't say anything and they'll take it as a narcissistic injury and they'll need to get you back. And so I think that plays out over and over again in these groups.
Certainly. And I would say it would probably differ from leader to leader. I think that a lot of them are using a very similar template, but they're applying it in a slightly different way. You know, my PhD research was not through primary data. So I basically reviewed dozens and dozens and, you know, well over 100 online discussion forum comments, you know, online newspaper, magazine articles, couple of books, you know, bunch of journals. And so the way that people describe the interactions with the trainer, you kind of see a bit of an evolution from the 70s up until now. What you tend to see more recently is as you said, it's the way that things are being said that makes you feel stupid or ashamed or whatever. They don't need to raise their voices. They don't need to act in that way. That they're able to get you to back down by using things like, as I said earlier, oh, you agreed that you were going to participate fully. It seems like you're not really allowing yourself to be vulnerable now, you know, or you said that you were going to be coachable. And, oh, you seem to be a person that goes back on your word. You try and intellectualize everything. Are you trying to make yourself look strong or clever in front of everyone now? Like, it'll be those sorts of things that the seminar leaders tend to be very good at in terms of getting people to just kind of go, okay. And it's not an even fight. You know, they have practiced this so many times before. They know exactly what to say. They're in this position of authority. Generally, they've got the majority of people who are sitting there going, I've paid my money. I want to get this transformation that I've been promised. And I've got this person over here who's standing in the way of this happening. They're ruining the experience for me. So that group pressure to just kind of conform and not ruin the experience for other people is quite strong as well. Janice Harkin and Richard Adams, who were researchers, I think from Portland State University, who studied the LifeSpring basic training and published on it in 1983. Richard Adams, as the one participant, was constantly being labeled the least attractive by other people in the seminar because he would query things and he had pushed back. And there was a person who had a psychotic break in the middle of their seminar, and he said, this seems to be a problem. And by that stage, everyone else that was in the seminar wanted to reframe it as this person's just getting in touch with their feelings and they were encouraging the person. And so if you are that person that's pushing back, you're not just challenging the leader, you're also challenging the other people who have now bought into this process and are wanting to get their transformation.
Right. You're kind of, you know, crashing their transformational party. And they've already, it's like the sunk cost fallacy. They've already put so much time and effort, right? So they're going to resist really having you hold a mirror up to what's happening here.
Yeah, and that actually leads on to something else. You said the sunk cost fallacy. So again, looking back at Cialdini, the idea of commitment and consistency, this idea that our behaviors are a much better predictor of our thinking than our thinking is of our behavior. And so in LGATs, almost all of the marketing or sales is done by graduates. So you graduate and then you're required to commit to bringing in a certain number of guests and to try and get them to take part. We've already spoken about the fact that this is really important because the new participants will be trusting and they won't leave as easily. That's a really important thing. Another really important thing is that the LGAT organization gets free sales. They don't have to do any above the line marketing, and that's really important. But the third thing that most people don't think about is the fact that as soon as you recruit a family member or a friend, you are openly, publicly committing to the organization. You're doing something that binds you psychologically. It makes it so much more difficult for you to acknowledge that maybe there was something problematic about it once somebody else that you know has now paid their money and taken part. So I think that that's a really important element that is often missed. These organizations have been saying forever that they're going to get rid of this pyramid style sales model where you're getting participants to recruit for them, and they never do. And I think a big reason for that is because it makes it more likely that you'll feel bound to the organization if you've publicly committed to them in some way.
Right. Right. Oh, absolutely. And I think even if they did make a public statement to say that we no longer do this, they would just call it something else. So it's not that you're recruiting. Maybe it would be selfish of you to just keep this information, you know.
That's exactly what they say.
Yeah. So before we finish up, I know our time is almost coming to a close. I'm curious about the after effects, you know, because That's a really important thing to discuss. And also when there is this sort of merging or this lack of clarity between bipolar that maybe you also have as part of your wiring, or was it created by the situation that you were in or exacerbated by the situation you were in? You need to kind of make sense of all of that and pick that apart once you've left. And so I'm sure that's a challenge among other things. So what have you noticed for talking to people who have left and for you too?
The problem is that there hasn't been a lot of longitudinal research in terms of how people have responded long-term. Certainly in terms of bipolar disorder and any sort of psychotic disorders, bipolar disorder in particular, I know more about that. So the median age of diagnosis is about 25. So you might have a whole bunch of people that are younger than 25 and who take part in these seminars. They may have the predisposition to develop the disorder, but they've never been engaged with something stressful enough to kick it off. So bipolar disorder is often looked at in terms of the diathesis stress model. So predisposition plus some sort of stressor kicks it off. So maybe that is the trigger for some people. And I do know of some people who were diagnosed after taking part in the seminars. Whether that would have happened anyway, I don't know. The one long-term study that was done on the forum was published in 1989, so Fisher et al. It looked at people, I think, 6 weeks after, which they considered short-term, and it looked at people 6 months or 8 months after, which they considered long-term. They found almost no short-term change in participants. So the reason that I would say that is that this transient euphoria, the transformation, I would say it tends to last for a couple of days to maximum a couple of weeks. So I wouldn't think that that would be picked up 6 weeks afterwards. And they found no long-term improvements or like problems, you know, 6 months later. So I would say that, you know, from a statistical perspective, if you are saying that 90 or 95% of participants are being positively transformed, which is the claim that a lot of these organizations make, then that study would certainly have picked that up. Okay, so if there's long-term transformation and you're saying it's pretty much everyone, it would pick it up. If you're saying that a small percentage of people are psychologically damaged, then there's a pretty good chance that that study wouldn't necessarily have picked that up because it's far less frequent. You'd need a bigger sample size to make any big statements about that. But I would say that a lot more research needs to be done about it. A lot of people that I speak to kind of say to themselves, you know, we were promised X, Y, and Z. If I look at my life 15 years later, 20 years later, and these are people that have been participating in these seminars for a long time, they say nothing's really changed. I think better research needs to be done, but there's no good research that indicates that there's positive change for the majority of people over the long term.
You know, it's like a cautionary tale. Be very careful before you get involved in anything like this because of this, among other reasons. Yeah, I think, you know, I've been working with people who, some of whom have been out of these situations for months and sometimes years, and they still have the same kind of inner dialogue that came from the group where they're second-guessing themselves and putting themselves down. And, you know, it hasn't helped. You know, there are these long delays I've noticed between sentences at times. If I ask someone their opinion or if I ask them to share a story with me about something that happened to them there seems to be this delay, and I'll ask what's happening during the delay. And it's often, is the story important enough? Am I wasting someone's time? Am I playing the victim? I mean, all the questions. And so it's very hard to just think and do and feel free to do that. And that stays with you, I think, until you get some help with it, actually, which is really unfortunate that people are left so burdened. It really is unconscionable, I think. Well, I want people to find out about what you're doing and where to read more of your work. And so where can people find you?
I've got a website. It's johnhunterphd.com. So everything's on there. All the podcasts I've done, you can find my PhD there if you've got a lot of time to spare. You know, it took me a long time to really work things out. And, you know, I'm a fairly obsessive, goal-directed type of person, and I managed to do quite a lot of, I think, pretty good work on it. But if you're interested in large group awareness trainings now, the learning curve is not steep. You know, I've had family members, you know, who are chartered accountants, they've got no background in psychology, read through my PhD in a couple of days and they understood it perfectly. It's written in a very simple way. I think the podcasts also explain most of the stuff. So if you put a week aside and just did some reading and watched a couple of videos, you could really know pretty much as I know in a short period of time. It's not going to take you that long to figure it out. The ideas I don't think are particularly complicated. And I think it's really empowering as well to understand, you know, what was done to you and the processes that were being used. It's useful to know the level of intellects of people that tend to buy into LGATs as well. So a bunch of studies have been done and you can see most people are college educated. Most of them, I mean, a lot of them are doing postgraduate qualifications or professional qualifications. So it's not fools. And I think if you read my PhD as well, the reason that I got interested in this is because I've thought such weird stuff when I've been in elevated states or depressed states. And so it's not about saying, you know, I'm the smart person who's worked this out. I'm a person who's thought really strange things at times. And I wanted to figure out how my mind could allow me to do that. And I think that it applies to people in large group awareness trainings as well. You know, in my case, I have elevated moods, but I don't have somebody deliberately trying to use those elevated moods to manipulate me. Whereas in a large group awareness training, you've got somebody who's elevating your mood and then doing very specific things to get you to believe very specific things. So the sort of closing message would be to not feel bad about it at all. It's a sophisticated process. It could work on anyone. So educate yourself, feel empowered.
Very nice. Really, really important message. I think one that's important also for a lot of people who deal with feeling shame or being shamed when they've had these experiences. And you're right. From what I've seen, people are very capable, very bright, but open and wanting to learn and are taken advantage of, but not through any fault of their own. So thank you so much for your work and thank you for sharing your time with us today. I hope we get a chance to talk again.
Sure. Thanks so much.
One more thing before you go. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much to Dr. John Hunter for his research and for coming on the show and sharing so much that really gets to the heart of the issue with large group awareness trainings. And knowing how many people I've worked with who have been participants in large group awareness trainings, who have been instructors in large group awareness trainings, and seeing the kind of euphoria that is induced, seeing the kind of behavior that is akin to bipolar behavior, seeing the kind of highs and lows that are manufactured so that people have a sense that they're having an experience filled with fervor, filled with intensity, something that feels life-changing, something that feels filled with this sort of possibility of everything now coming into awareness and being able to achieve everything you've ever wanted to achieve and understand everything you've ever wanted to understand. We can all get caught up in those moments. I think about times that I've gone to summer camp and the last morning, everyone's saying goodbye and one person starts crying and singing and swaying and everyone else is crying and singing and swaying. And that's not at a large group awareness training. It's just social psychology. But it's also true that when you are in these groups, there is no stopgap measure to make sure that what you're being put through and what your nervous system is being put through by being ramped up in this way is actually safe. No one's watching to make sure that you haven't passed a threshold. And when you do pass a threshold in these groups, you're very often discarded. You then come across as out of control. You come across as someone who can no longer be controlled. But they've induced it in you, and then they dismiss you for it. It can be a very cruel, cruel place. It is really important to talk a little bit now, though, about his point about repetition. That when something is repeated over and over again, it seems like it's true because we've heard it over and over. If someone we respect, someone who's in a position of authority, says it over and over, we are more likely to believe it. If it seems clever, if it rhymes, if it's short and to the point, if it's said with punch, then we also believe it. I remember a lot of kind of quotes and things, sayings that I was raised with. One I was thinking about the other day, and this is a very 80s kind of phrase, and it was written on things, and I remember we had a pad of paper in our house. That was a gift, actually. I remember my mom just throwing it away because the message actually wasn't one that spoke to us at all in our family, but it was very 80s. The phrase, and see if you remember this, was you can never be too rich or too thin. Both those things are false. But there was this quote that was remembered. I still remember it now. And it's something that people started to live by because they thought that's the way to think. But it's actually very dangerous. But you don't know that because it sounds like this very kind of peppy mantra. And it sounds safe. And it sounds motivational. And it sounds like that should be your goal. So often, when people are given information in cultic groups, when you break it down, it doesn't always make a lot of sense. It might sometimes ring true, but sometimes it really doesn't. But it actually doesn't matter. It should matter, but it doesn't. And people will sometimes just repeat phrases that they've learned because they think that's the way to think. And not only do they think that way and have those mantras in their head and those quotes in their head, they pass them on to other people because there are these pithy little sayings that you can then give to someone else if they're having a hard time, if they need a little motivation, if they need affirmation. There's a quote that I remember someone saying to me when I was having car trouble one time. And she said to me, "You are not your car." And she had learned that in Landmark. And I thought, what? Like I knew that. But she said it to me like she was quoting the Bible or Shakespeare or someone who had offered her some piece of information that was going to be so helpful to me, as though I needed some way to reframe something in my life. You can be frustrated if your car breaks down a lot. That's okay. That's understandable. But in these large group awareness trainings, there's no room for you to have a negative reaction to things. So in that space, someone's going to jump in and tell you about what to think and how to think about this moment and what you're supposed to feel. So yeah, I'm not my car. Sure, that's obvious. I understand what that point was about, but still what that does is it keeps you from being able to be frustrated, naturally frustrated. It also keeps the other person from offering you any kind of support, like, oh, yeah, I know that must suck. Oh, that's so frustrating. Or, oh, God, you know, yeah, I hate when that happens. In these large group awareness trainings, you're not going to get that. You're going to get the, you shouldn't be thinking this way. And I'm going to teach you how you're supposed to be thinking about this. And the way that I'm going to get you to do it is I'm going to throw an expression at you. It's sort of like I picture in a lot of these larger awareness trainings that someone has gone through to some kind of card store and picked all of these motivational cards, sort of Hallmark type cards, and has just started throwing them at you. And so you just get hit with one phrase after another after another. And some of them might stick, some of them might land, but a lot of them seem like they don't quite fit the situation. But it's the other person also thinking that this is the way they're helping you. It's not helping. And it's keeping you from being able, again, to have a natural reaction to something that might be negative, and that's okay. And it keeps the other person who's hearing you from having a space, a place in that moment of offering solace and support. While you can feel in a whole group of people and everyone is charged up and all together, you can feel so alone in those moments when your emotions aren't matched, when they're not met, when it seems like people don't care. They just need to move you to the next emotion as fast as possible. Thank you so much to John for letting us know the dangers inherent in these groups. And these are places that are supposed to give you this sense of really mastering your emotions, but instead cause so much stress and sometimes psychological torment and so much isolation, even in the midst of a room of hundreds of people. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's Durafighter interior paint is a paint and primer in one with a tough, lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's Durafighter paint and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.